Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Now, normally it's Curtis and Jim and myself, and it's the three of us again today, but we also have a fourth, a fourth musketeer, a fourth cohort. We've got a guest. Of course, I'm talking about Lanny Cass, and many of you may or may not know Lanny. And Lanny, you know, she spent a career in the military. You know, she was an Air Force officer in the Israeli Air Force, and then you know, she was an Israeli by sort of birth or by immigration. And then she was an American by choice, and she's been an American and served the U.S. military for, you know, many, many, many years. And then now she's in the good, fortunate position to be retired and enjoying life and writing a little and commenting a little. And, you know, she can, you know, like my grandparents who are far, far older than Lanny, by the way.
Thank you.
But she has the chance to pay attention to the news a lot more these days than probably when she was beating the halls at the Pentagon. And so she's sort of up to date and has a distinct and sort of unique perspective about the failure of deterrence on October the 7th, 2023, and then the ties of Iran to this, you know, this widening war that's taking place in the Middle East right now. And so, and I thought, you know, it's been a year because we talked about a year ago when this war kicked off. Lanny was on NucleCast, and then we're now a little over a year later, and it's, hey, let's reflect on this and sort of see, you know, what we now know about its beginnings and sort of how it's developed. You know, we've had Iran attack Israel twice. I mean, that's a very clear act of war against a nuclear armed state. And what does that mean? And there's, you know, there's lots of sort of dynamics here at play. And so, Lanny, you know, welcome to the NIDS View. Thanks for joining us and sort of adding your take to the roundtable discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam. It's a pleasure to be with you. And it's an honor to be with Jim and Curtis and, of course, you. So I appreciate the opportunity to share the podcast with you. A lot of interesting things going on. I need to make a disclaimer. I am a private citizen right now. Anything I say does not reflect the positions of the Department of Defense. And not to correct the moderator, remember, Israel does not acknowledge is a nuclear power, even though every child above the age of 7 in Israel knows that that thing in Dimona is not a textile factory.
don't worry, I get corrected all the time. So
he's used to it, Lonnie.
Way to go, Adam. That's like three, I think, in your monologue. So, okay.
So of course, you know, we like to tell jokes, and we've had to tone it down a little bit, but that's okay. So, we were talking before the break, and you said a couple things that I found interesting. You know, you said deterrence failed on October 7th, 2023, and you said it all begins in Iran. And then the third thing you said that was interesting is that people shouldn't see this as an irregular war between Israel and Hamas or Israel and Hezbollah. So can you, you know, sort of delve into that a little bit more so that we can sort of toss that around?
Sure. Well, I mean, the obvious thing is that the unprecedented terror attack on Israel on the morning of October 7 last year, a holiday Saturday, meaning everybody's alertness was at a very low level. And perhaps it's worth mentioning, it is the same holiday, Jewish holiday period in which we are right now. And it's almost a month that you have back-to-back holidays. So kind of like in the United States, nothing important is ever done between Thanksgiving and New Year's. In Israel, and it's kind of the manana thing after the holidays, means people are on leave, people are on vacation, people don't and certainly don't anticipate a surprise attack. Mm-hmm. So that's truly important to understand. And the failure of deterrence is that Hamas broke a ceasefire, broke an effective truce that was negotiated with the help of the United States. Remember, Israel is not in Gaza, hasn't been in Gaza since 2005. Gaza is the only Judenrein place on planet Earth, in addition to, well, Saudi Arabia. There are no Jews allowed there. So it's not exactly occupied territory, and you have a direct invasion of a sovereign country from the Gaza Strip on October 7. Absolute paralyzing failure of deterrence. Like the United States, Israel's strategy is predicated on deterrence. And as I'm sure you discussed on numerous occasions, Curtis and Jim being experts on deterrence, deterrence is a function of capability and will, an opponent's perception of those capabilities and will. If any of the factors in that equation, and those aren't pluses, they multiplication signs, if any of those factors is zero or trending down, it will affect deterrence. If anyone is zero, deterrence does not obtain. I would submit deterrence broke down on that day. Over to you.
Now, would you say it was because of Iran? And this is, I know, what I was channeling Curtis's inner thoughts on this one.
How's that, going?
Stay out of my brain, Adam.
So was Iran literally, you know, encouraging, poking, prodding, looking for this to happen? Because for Hamas, I would submit Hamas probably they underestimated what Israel's response would be. They thought they would strike
I would disagree, Adam.
Okay.
I would fundamentally disagree. Israel's response is precisely what Hamas anticipated. And the reason I am not thinking about the conflict in terms of irregular warfare or counterinsurgency is that none of those organizations, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, even the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, they are not independent actors. They are tools of Iran. I would take it one step further and submit they are Iran's deterrents. Because especially Hezbollah, which most people don't realize, makes Al-Qaeda and ISIS look like junior varsity. It is global. It is in Central America. It has killed Americans. I mean, I'm just astounded by how people don't understand what Hezbollah is. But they are the protective shield for Iran. In other words, you have almost an inversion of deterrence, upside down deterrence, because from the Iranians' perspective, the reason they built those militias on Israel's border, the so-called Ring of Fire, was designed to contain Israel and prevent it from striking Iran, which, if you look at the map, is quite a distance from Israel, and of course has almost zero conventional Air Force capability. It has missiles and drones, which is an interesting factor to consider, a country under sanctions that still is trying to fly F-4s and F-14s, Tomcats, and Phantoms, you know, which no military on the planet has, except in museums, has these advanced missiles. You've got to ask yourself how an isolated enclave, you know, the size smaller than the state of Delaware, I mean, it's nothing, it's tiny, is capable of firing all these missiles into Israel a year after a pretty extensive military operations. It is all supplied by Iran. And the Houthis are an Iranian militia, with what most people forget, that the Saudis have been fighting against the Houthis, who are Shia, like Iran, in a very brutal civil war for a decade with U.S. support. And we put pressure on the Saudis because, you know, it was a pretty awful war and a lot of people were dying. And now the Houthis are messing up international shipping in very critical area of the world, the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. They located in Yemen. But you're talking about an illiterate ragtag militia that is firing sophisticated ballistic missiles capable of reaching Israel. So looking at it as an insurgency, resistance, you know, whatever BS you choose, it's you're just looking at it through the wrong part of the telescope. You need to invert it. It all begins and ends with Iran.
Curtis, that's fascinating. I never thought of what I've read now, the axis of resistance, right? These Iranian proxies as being actually, if maybe a forward deployed army. They can't get the IRGC, you know, all that distance, right? They have to go through all those other nations to get there. And so the idea of a massive armor battle between Iranian tanks and Israeli tanks is probably never going to happen because of the distance, the tyranny of distance. So that's a fascinating thing. And I get where you're coming from. I think, let me ask you this, though. Obviously, there isn't anything in this world that doesn't run on money. And there's been a lot of controversy about the administration and other administrations in the past allowing removing sanctions, allowing more money to flow into Iran, whether it's to sort of entice them into getting back into a JCPOA-like agreement or just trying to, you know, the United States is not above paying bribes for peace, right? And in essence, are we funding some of this? Is this something
yes,
that the American
are.
Taxpayer should be upset about?
Yes, Curtis, and I think you put your finger on the critical factor in this entire equation. America's fight with Iran dates back to 1979. Carter was the president. Mm-hmm. You might recall our ally, the Shah, was toppled.
Right.
The Mullahs came into power. And the first thing that they did is take over the American embassy and hold our diplomats hostage for 444 days. So our America's fight with Iran goes back to that time. Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy, and I think you articulated it beautifully, it is the forward deployed military, doesn't have tanks, it has ballistic missiles.
Yes, it does.
even worse. And surrounds Israel. I would not use the term axis of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranian term and the Arabic term is the ring of fire. Mm-hmm. And I think it illustrates it much better. I mean, you literally surround Israel. Now, when you look at the map, you will see that you have a concerted Iranian effort starting in 1979 to expand the so-called Shia Crescent, which goes now from the Persian Gulf, Iran, Iraq, which was majority Shia, and we should have known what will happen when you topple a minority regime, Sunni, Saddam Hussein, the Shias right. come to power, that's now an Iranian proxy, extending northwest toward Syria. Civil war in Syria, again, U.S. involvement. President Assad belongs to a sect, Alawite, but that is a Sunni sect, and Lebanon, so you have access to the Mediterranean through both Syria and Lebanon, bordering Turkey, which itself now is at risk of becoming a part of this Shia crescent.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a strategic movement. It's, you know, chess was invented by the Persians, you know, and it's been going on for decades. We are focused on how patient the Chinese are, right. and they are, but so are the Persians. The Persians aren't Arabs. They consider themselves superior to the Arabs. But to answer your question directly, yes, absolutely. Iran was under massive sanctions. All of the sudden, we opened and shipped pallets of money. They also got their hands on money that we gave to Iraq and, frankly, equipment which we left in Afghanistan. Again, people don't know geography. Part of Afghanistan, aka Balochistan, is Shia.
Hmm.
So that whole notion of this crescent is very, very strategic, extending to the Persian Gulf, the Indian Ocean, the Mediterranean, as well as the Red Sea via the Houthis, bordering Saudi Arabia, the center of Sunni Islam and the leader of the Arab world, hence the importance of the Abraham Accords.
Right.
But yes, ask yourself how a country under sanctions, not a country, but a territory, Gaza, has access to this kind of weaponry. There are only two ways to get into Gaza. Three, actually. One, through the Med. There are no major ports in Gaza. Remember, we had to build a pier, which itself was, you know, a goat grope. Can we say bad words?
No, we cannot. We're a family-friendly show.
So it was pretty much a Charlie Foxtrot, okay? I mean, there is no two ways about it.
Right.
But you can smuggle by little boats into Gaza. The border with Israel is open only for humanitarian assistance and people coming to walk because, you know, there was a ceasefire. So people from Gaza were coming into Israel for employment. But the third and most important way, and that's another failure of deterrence, is the vast majority of those weapons came through Egypt, which has a peace treaty with Israel, which is the second largest recipient of American foreign aid. You've got to, regardless of your political view, to ask yourself, can you make any agreements with in this neighborhood? Remember, during the Cold War, we all focused on arms control with the Soviet Union and later Russia. And we always said, well, they're cheating. All right, but the arms control defined the parameters of the cheating. You know, so it was a good thing. Oh, yeah. It also got you visibility. I think Israel was astounded by the amount of weaponry that entered Gaza and was found in Gaza. The other point that most people don't realize, Lebanon is a failed state. Lebanon used to be the Switzerland of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. When I was in Israel in the 70s, in the early 80s, 60s, it was literally the Switzerland of the Middle East, very diverse, majority Christian country. It is a failed state, and it is a failed state because of Hezbollah. You know, even I did not realize that Lebanon has not had a president for the last 2 years. The position is vacant. By law and constitution, the president is a Christian. There is none. One got assassinated, the other got fired. He's also the richest man in Lebanon and decided that's, you know, not worth dying for. So Lebanon doesn't have a functioning government. Into that vacuum stepped Hezbollah and the IRGC, and they're effectively running Lebanon. Yeah. They destroyed the country.
Right.
One last point. The United States has been arming the Lebanese armed forces for decades, arming and training as part of our foreign military assistance. It made sense. It was strategic until we realized that Hezbollah is getting all the weapons and the training. You know, so then we stopped. But, you know, you can't unring the bell. It's already gone. It's there. So.
Right. Adam?
Well, I mean, this has been sort of a enlightening discussion thus far. Jim, you've been pretty quiet. Was there any sort of, I don't know, light bulb that's gone off in your mind as you've sort of listened to Lanny's lay out the, you know, sort of the lay of the land and how she sees, you know, this, you know, these problems working themselves? And or are you just sort of in awe of her responses? But maybe that's the case.
Lanny, I will say I am, and that's probably a good description of where I am. I am in awe of the intricacies that you've described to us here. And I don't think many in our audience really understand all the nuance to every single step that you had mentioned. And so I really appreciate that. So I am somewhat in awe. I'm going to turn this a little bit differently. Cause you said when Adam had asked, whether this was turning out the way that Hezbollah had assumed it would turn out. And you said you thought that it was. So now that the war has been going on for over a year and there have been two additional attacks, which means deterrence is still continuing to fail in this region. Right. And I'm curious because I could not imagine being in the situation as an Israeli and hearing the comments that are made from the worldwide international leaders about their response to protecting themselves and continuing to protect themselves. And I'm curious as to your comments on that piece and how we can get back to a deterrence when these kind of things are going on. I'll leave it to you. I'm excited to hear your answer.
Thank you, Jim. No, that's a great...
Hey, before so you respond, I got to point out one thing. Yes. Jim has, you know, Jim's an engineer. And as an engineer, he thinks what engineers do is harder than what we do as social scientists. But I think after his, you know, being deafened in awe by your words has clearly shown that he now recognizes, as did Albert Einstein, that social science is far harder than engineering physics. So, I think
wait a minute, Adam. But my comment was only related to you, Adam. And if you are my sample set, I will stand on that. Lanny may change my sample set. Thank you, Lanny.
Okay, go ahead, Lanny. Go ahead.
Your point, Jim. Deterrence has not been restored because Israel has been shackled. And again, I will give you my very personal opinion on that. The war in Gaza would have been over in 3 weeks if Israel was allowed to do what it wanted to do. What the United States forced Israel to do instead is, if you want a manual on how not to conduct urban operations, it's right there. It needed to be done to restore deterrence fast, hard, and get out. Instead, it's house to house, building to building against an embedded terrorist organization which has an entire underground city, tunnels, from which they infiltrated and invaded Israel. Israel has demonstrated weakness in its response. In the Middle East, power is currency. That will aspect of deterrence, not the capability. Everybody knows you have the capability. But if you don't have the will to employ that capability, and it doesn't matter if you don't have the will or your best friend in the whole world forever doesn't allow you to have the well, deterrence doesn't obtain. So Hamas has perceived the Israeli response as a weakness. It has perceived the global reaction as a victory, and it is. And if you think that a bunch of terrorists sitting in tunnels in Gaza orchestrated it, you don't understand what's going on in the Middle East. It was orchestrated by Iran. If you look at the very first anti-Israeli demonstration, it's in London on October 8th, okay? Israel didn't do anything till October 18th. So, I mean, the military response didn't start right away. So you immediately have anti-Israeli demonstration. Every time you hear the president, the vice president, Secretary Blinken, you name it, saying, well, Israel has the right to self-defense, which obviously it does. Why would you even say that? It's in the UN Charter. You know, I mean, you don't need to state the obvious. You don't start every presentation with the sky is blue, right? You know, in apples, to use an engineering example, there is gravity.
That's right.
And apples fall down. So deterrence will not be restored until Israel strikes back at Iran and strikes hard. The reaction to the first attack, unprecedented. The United States immediately put pressure on Israel, don't rock the boat, you know, because we're negotiating the hostages. That's what I said, Adam. Israel is exactly where Hamas and Iran wanted it to be, because the hostages are leverage. And I think, again, nobody in the United States understands how important that is to Israel. Back in 2002 or 5, don't remember, Israel traded 1,000 Palestinian prisoners for one private. Think about it.
Right.
We traded a major arms dealer for Brittany, what's her name, you know, the women's basketball player, leaving a Marine to rot in a Russian jail. You know, just we just traded one. Israel traded 1,000 to include Sinwar, the architect of the October attack. Of course, nobody knew that. A little known fact, Sinwar had brain cancer, which was diagnosed and treated at Israeli taxpayer expense while he was jailed. If he was in Gaza, he would probably be dead. But that's, you know, just a irony of history. So Israel is the only country on planet Earth that is being threatened with an embargo for not feeding its enemy, which is still sending missiles into population centers. The invasion, and I will use that term in I have a Columbia PhD, and that includes international law. What happened on October 7 is an invasion of a sovereign border, not occupied territory, not disputed territory. This is Israeli territory within what's called the Green Line, ceasefire lines from 1948. Everybody recognizes that as a border. So a weak response, I'm getting back to your question, I'm sorry, I kind of got wound up. A weak response does not restore deterrence because the capability factor is there, but the will is not. And that applies to Hamas. And that applies to Iran. The retaliation for the first attack in April was a pinprick. You demonstrated capability. You didn't demonstrate well. Certainly in your opponent's perception, you demonstrated nothing. Mm-hmm. And deterrence is always in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. You're not deterring yourself. You're trying to deter somebody else. You guys know that better right. than anybody. It is in the eye of the beholder. Iran does not believe that Israel has the will, and it believes that the United States will restrain Israel. I do believe full moon is on Thursday. And if I'm wrong, I'll come on your podcast and publicly eat my hat. Deterrence will be restored.
There you go.
Wow.
There we go. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it with Lanny's last words. Deterrence will be restored.
If I could give one observation before we wrap it up, and again, Lonnie knows this better than anybody else, but for our audience, the 1973 Yom Kippur War, largely viewed as an intelligence failure on part of Israel, same time frame as we're talking about now.
Yeah.
And yes, so maybe we could realize that these holidays tend to be the the time when you might want your most vigilance as you're looking through these things. I would like to invite you back, Lonnie, because I really want to have a chance to discuss your thoughts on the failure of deterrence by denial, the idea that 300 missiles attack Israel. They're almost all taken out, and yet it does not deter Iran from doing it again.
And it does not matter.
Yes, and so I think what's interesting is that the perception that you've talked about in the Kissinger formula is still not connecting. And I really would like to get your thoughts on that, especially from the Iranian mindset, if you will.
You got it.
On that. So anyway, thanks again for being here. I really learned a lot. I really enjoyed having you here. Adam, back to you.
All right. So, of course, we want to thanks to Lonnie for being here, and Jim and Curtis, and appreciate Jim being in awe of a social scientist. And hopefully you, the listeners, were in awe as well.
Jealousy will get you nowhere, my friend.
Hopefully you, the listeners, enjoyed it, of course. And remember, you can reach out. We've got the NIDS View. Don't forget about Deterrence Down Under or Real Space Strategy, our other podcasts. And don't forget about Global Security Review. I'm sure Lanny, I'm signing her up right now to write an article. She's going to write an article for Global Security Review. So we'll get more of Lanny's thoughts on this. We'll get them on GSR. And so reach out. Of course, there's thinkdeterrence.com, and Curtis is on Twitter, and he's always got some interesting articles and wise words. So hit us up. And then, of course, we're on LinkedIn, everybody. So join us there. And, of course, thanks, Lanny, once more. And we will see you on the next episode of The NIDS View. Oh.
Thank you.
And as I always say, and almost forgot to say this time, always remember to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.